And now, it's time for the Talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning to you. It's just turning 4 minutes past nine on this Friday, the 1st of March, 2024. You're very welcome along to another month and another edition of the 9 till noon show, the last one of this week, and loads coming up over the next 3 hours to keep you informed and entertained. And we're going to kick off our first hour with our Friday panel. I'll introduce them to you after I invite you to have your say throughout the course of the hour. 086 60 25000, WhatsApps and texts to that telephone number. You can voice note to the WhatsApp number as well. You can give us a call on 07491 25000, or email comments at highlandradio.com. And if it suits you and you want to watch the show, you can put us up on your big TV. If it's a smart TV, open the YouTube app, Highland Radio Ireland. Same thing with your Fire Stick. We're across your mobile devices on YouTube and Facebook as well. Highland Hub, Highland News and Sport, and on X. Good morning to you if you're watching us on X as well. Right, let's say hello to the Friday panel. Firstly, Councillor Nicholas Crossan, Independent Councillor in the Inishowen Municipal District. Good morning to you, Nicholas. Good to have you back on the show.
Good morning,
Nicholas. Professor Pat O'Connor, Professor of Sociology and Social Policy at University of Limerick. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning, Craig.
Always a pleasure to have you with us. And last but not least, Deputy Joe McHugh. Good morning, Joe. Thanks for the time this morning.
Margin Way, Greg.
Good to have you with us, Margin Way. Right, okay. Shall I get a quick word with you on this sign that's appeared in Buncrana, Nicholas?
Oh, yeah, well, whatever you want, Greg. It doesn't really matter, but I wouldn't want to take up too much time with the rest of the people. But
well, no, just is it controversial? Jack Murray says his phone hasn't stopped ringing, inquiring about this 30-foot sign. I saw a picture of it. It looks pretty enough. Didn't need planning permission. Do you have a hand in this, Nicholas?
Oh, yes. That's out of the mayor funding, Greg, that you're entitled as a mayor of the county to do something in your local area. So I approached the St. Patrick's Day, which I was a member of St. Patrick's Day Committee, and asked them, would we put up a sign in memory of the past members of St. Patrick's Day Committee in Buncrana, which served Buncrana from the mid-80s right through up to the present day, actually.
And Councillor Murray saying that the public should have had a say before it was erected. I mean, do you agree with him? Disagree?
Well, if we were to agree, I asked for people have said to me, nobody has phoned me, first of all, to ask make any inquiries about the location of it. Anybody that phoned me, and I got phone calls from as far away as Australia, actually, saying that it's a lovely job, can't wait for summer to get a photograph to put it posted on it. But I mean, the bus shelter or the bike shelter was erected down there, and I certainly wasn't told about it. But for the councillors, I think it's a bit disingenuous for the councillors to say that they knew nothing about this. Paul Canning, Martin Farn, Martin McDermott, Johnny McGuinness all knew what they were voting for and voted for funding to erect this sign, and that was last year as a minor tourism grant. Councillor Murray said on what was sent to me, I don't do Facebook, it was sent to me that he knew absolutely nothing about it. And then he raised it on Monday. And I told him on Monday that he voted for it. And the engineer, Michael McFadden, told him that he voted for it. So maybe Deputy McHugh might be able to come on here. Maybe it's election season starting early. But maybe they haven't got the notice that I'm not running.
Okay. I don't know if you have a view on it, Deputy McHugh. Have you seen the imagery of it, or I don't know, the process of it?
Well, I suppose me and Nicholas are on the same page. We're not running again, so we can give us more flexibility in this issue. But look, I wouldn't know the intricacies of it, but I would say one thing. If, you know, at the end of the day, the people in the electoral area or the municipal district voted for the councillors. Like, and if you were to go back and get the opinion of the public on every single issue, I don't think anything would be done. But that's only my
opinion. The bus that Nicholas tried to throw you under there, you dodged quite perfectly, I think.
I was good at that.
All right, easy on, lads. Professor O'Connor, me and you are somewhat removed from it. I'm not sure if you have an opinion on it. I'm going to leave it to the boys. It's up to you, though.
No, I have no opinion. I'm afraid it's all news to me.
Okay, I just wanted a quick word from Nicholas on that. there's a few things we want to get through. I just want to mention this one because it's on the front of the papers today. Fianna Fáil drawing up a new party policy on immigration in the clearest sign yet that the topic is moving centre stage ahead of the upcoming local elections. The main parties in Leinster House have all struggled, I think we can agree, with the issue in recent months as protests mounted over the location of asylum seeker accommodation. Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have both faced situations where local reps have defied the party leadership and criticised the government. Sinn Féin too have been accused of really not having a firm policy or a coherent message on immigration, but it's clear it's going to be a very interesting period for this election and no doubt the following general election. I don't think it's any surprise to anyone, is it, Professor O'Connor, that immigration is going to be front and centre as we approach the local elections and beyond?
I think it's certainly going to be very important. I don't know if it's going to be more important than issues like housing. I think some of the problems have been caused by the government opting for the quick solution of hotel accommodation and really not planning ahead in terms of thinking what were the knock-on consequences of that. And it is becoming very obvious that the knock-on consequences include the implications for tourist, non-accommodation tourist industries, which are really greatly affected by this. I suppose what has also become clear is that the government hasn't really been sharp enough in terms of seeing anomalies that the situation has created, which have irritated people. Do you know that where they see that those who have come to the country are being treated differently to and more in, they would argue, more favourably than citizens. That has caused a problem. And of course, internationally, then you have the fact that 1,000 men, largely men, are basically living in tents is going to get us into trouble internationally. So really, the government, I do think part of the problem has been giving it to Roderick O'Gorman.
But is that not a concern, though, that this government or any government would not see this coming? Because one of the very, very first conversations when it emerged that a hotel, I think it was the first in Donegal, in Letterkenny, was to be used to house refugees. On day one, before a refugee had walked into it, on this programme, we were debating the impact that would have on tourism, local news agents, local cafes, and so on and so forth. So it was very, very clear, even to an imbecile like me, from day one before a refugee moved in, that these would be the consequences of these actions. So is that in and of itself that we're so far down the line and maybe now people are waking up to it? That's a concern.
Yes, it is a concern. I do think that the initial allocating the Red Cross, going back to way back, the Red Cross to deal with it was completely ineffective. I saw in Waterford how, you know, people who are willing to offer accommodation were totally frustrated by the, really, it was too big a task for the Red Cross.
And it became a cash cow. I mean, there are multi-millionaires in this country now. And yet there are people who offered their homes that never got a call back.
No, exactly. And you have to wonder in terms of, you know, was the unwillingness to face up to the social implications of the use of hotels and centres, was there a vested interest, basically, in going down those roads rather than going down the road of providing accommodation? Or even, in some cases, using, for example, networks of people existing in the country to find solutions. The quick solution was adopted, and really the government has reaped a whirlwind on it now.
Okay, I'll come back to you. I would never contradict Professor O'Connor, Joe McHugh, but in terms of it being maybe not being the top topic, I believe it will be, and for the reason why housing would be the other competitor to it. It's so complex. It's so medium term. It's so long term. It's about delivery. It's about working numbers to say we're doing really well or we're not doing really well. Or Sinn Féin saying we will build a house for everyone or whatever it might be. Whereas immigration is incredibly simple. And a lot of that was articulated by Pat O'Connor. And often I think, and we saw with Brexit, for an example, the easier to articulate and to swing people on is often what ends up being the principal agenda. And would be the reason why I think immigration is going to be the hot one.
Yeah, look, I think Professor Connor certainly was hitting a couple of very important points there in terms of what went wrong in terms of the overall process. If it was, if we go back to the very, very beginning, there was such a warm and open and embracing of immigration at a community level. And the amount of people I know that signed up for their houses to bring in Ukrainians, people who were embracing the whole concept of a war-torn country and looking after people who were losing family members and having to come to a strange country. So I think what has happened, I think there's been the lack of openness and transparency around it. Communities, while embracing it, and you only look at examples, even I was in the Letterkenny Park run there on Saturday morning, and communities are still embracing that inclusiveness. Over Christmas, I was in Boris O'Kane. There's so many people and communities still embracing it. But what's missing, the missing piece of the jigsaw, is there's been a lack of openness, a lack of transparency, and a lack of communication.
Has that been purposeful? Has that been done on purpose? Because we can go all the way back to Mobile when there was talk of refugees or international protection applicants. I can't remember exactly which, coming into Mobile. There were public meetings, concerned about local school places, concerned about GP resources, pressure on the local hospital. This is going back way before Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And it seemed that the policy then was outlined that, well, if we did consultation everywhere we go, we'd never get anything done. So the points that you say it's a failure on, was that not really, or is that not really policy? Ask for forgiveness.
I think there was I think there was a complete lack of policy, Greg, because everything happened so quickly and it became a numbers game, and there were so many in tents, there were so many in City West, and we've so many today, we've X amount to get into accommodation. And then all of a sudden hotels became the easy option because they didn't have to be refurbished, they were ready to go. And as was the sad reality, 2 years plus into the war, we have a situation where we had a lot of state buildings. We had a lot of buildings that were mooted by many politicians, including myself, to the department that could have been used with local labour that could have been organised. So there were opportunities missed there. And I think then, Greg, it became a numbers game, and it became, with so many overnight in tents, we have to get them down the road or up the road or over the road. We need to get them in summer. And it became a reactive thing. And anytime you're reacting and you're not being proactive and you're not being organized and you're not being deliberate about a thing, it goes wrong, as in this case.
What's the solution, though? You know, I mean, like, I wouldn't like to be going to doorsteps trying to articulate in a show, for an example, when people in some cases are struggling to get GPs, GP services, or, you know, they're struggling to get their children to school, but see a bus going up with just two Ukrainian children on it or whatever. And it's not based in any racism. It's purely about fairness. And things not being seen to be fair. Like, I wouldn't like to be going on the doorsteps trying to articulate a particular point of view to the general public. Is that something you would look forward to?
Well, so I'm not going onto the doorsteps, but I would be saying no different to what if I were going on the doorsteps. I think what needs to be done is we need to highlight the good aspects. Like, there's so many refugees and, whether it's, foreign nationals, whether it's Ukrainian, so many refugees, so many people that have come to our shores that are retraining, reskilling, are part of the community. And I think, in fairness to different groups, and I know the ETB are doing great work around this along with Solace, they have the evidence and they're producing the results in relation to people coming back and upskilling. Now, you do hear of cases where maybe you have an obstetrician from Ukraine coming in and doesn't have the language to meet the desired qualifications to become an obstetrician in this country, and then ends up doing something else. But look, that's just one example. There's loads of other examples where there is a big effort. And I think we need to make that more public, because at the end of the day, immigration or history of immigration in this country, it was the women that built the NHS in the UK, and it was the men that built the tunnels and the roads. You know, the people that come to our shores are contributing, and they will contribute.
Yeah, and I think there is sort of two tracks here, in that there are families and children, mm-hmm. and women and children, and I think then there are large groups of I don't know what the relationship status are, but they come here on their own. and attitudes, I think, are different between those two groups. But anyway, we can come back to that. Nicholas Cross, in your view?
Well, my view, just well, it's been very well articulated by the two, Professor Pat and Deputy McHugh there. I do believe that this has snowballed, that the government at the start, we were very welcome to refugees from Ukraine coming in. People were offering accommodation in their own houses for it. But the numbers outgrew what we thought, and there was no future planning for it from the government. I said, the transparency was light on the ground, because I know that we were asked as councillors, do you know this is happening? And we could put the hand on heart and say, look, we knew nothing about it. But I think it has snowballed out of all proportion. And I do believe it will be an election issue, a huge election issue come, especially for local elections.
Now, we had contact from a person who was getting €800 a month to house two Ukrainians in their two bedrooms of their house. They went to renew their house insurance, €1,900 their house insurance renewal quote was. They went back to the people they're liaising with and they says, no, you get £800 and that's it. You know what I mean? Everything has to come out of that. That person's now thinking of exiting that process, giving up the accommodation, and probably within a stone's throw of where they are, you've got business people, not business people, making millions and millions and millions of euros. So that's we treat one sector, the business side of it, one way, and those that arguably did the right thing, we can't even make a consideration for them that their house insurance has quadrupled because they are housing Ukrainians for €800 a month. It's crazy.
I agree 100% with you, and it's that is a money factor for individuals probably trying to do the right thing. The other thing is our hotels and our hostels have gone for this tourism season, and that's my biggest fear, that people were looking, and if there's only one hotel available in a town and it's booked up, well, that's going to cut down our tourism season, and that's what I'm afraid of more than anything else, Greg.
Yeah, that's a reality. It is going to happen. We've seen it, and we're going into another year. Pat, do you want a quick word on this before the first break?
I suppose I do think that even at this late stage, the government needs to think where it goes from here. Do you know what I mean? In a way, there have been mutterings that you feel almost the government is, quote, hoping that people might go back to Ukraine before the 3-year period, which is up next March, which the government committed to. But it is very clear that the war will still be going on at that stage. So in a way, there does need, very belatedly, need to be forward thinking. On the positive note, I suppose, what has been interesting is to see how many small schools in the West have been saved by Ukrainian children, saved in inverted commas, ones that basically were on incredibly low numbers, who are absolutely delighted now, who in some cases have been able to have an extra teacher. So that there has been a totally unexpected upsides. But the difficulty, I think, the real shoe is pinching on accommodation. And, I mean, in a way, the whole question, I don't know if the government has really thought through, if people are in employment, should they not be contributing to their rent? Do you know if they're getting, that's a cause of irritation to some
because
people.
There is also another issue that is discussed, but it hasn't really, I don't think, been discussed broadly publicly, is that there are there is an awful lot of competition in the private rental market, and a lot of Ukrainian families are quite well placed in that they have been in hotel accommodation and received quite a lot of money and been able to accumulate some money. And that gives them, against families who are more hard-pressed, a competitive advantage in the private rental market as well.
Yes, I mean, in a way, the complexities, when you get down to nitty-gritty, the anomalies are huge. But you have the feeling that, Councillor McHugh, that many of the politicians aren't actually seeing the nitty-gritty, whereas the voting public are seeing the nitty-gritty, and there needs to be tweaking of regulations at a very local, at a very micro level, for people to see that the thing is operating fairly, which, as my colleagues have said, is a cause of great aggravation now.
Okay. Councillor McHugh. Sounds good, but he got deputy status after that. Ministerial status.
Oh, sorry.
Back down to deputy, and we don't know what he is now. Is he in or out of Fine Gael? It's like the hokey cokey. We'll see. You'll jump in before you'll put your left.
We should call my first name.
So you'll put
that would do the job. Yeah.
You'll put your left foot in. Will you just before you hang up the.
When Pat was calling me councillor, I was thinking on a label, and I heard the one about Postman Pat. The time Postman Pat lost the job, you know what they called him, Greg?
Pat.
Pat, yeah. Joe,
have to be careful with every word you say on this program because our listeners are so eagle-eared. Joe just said he'll not be knocking on doors. Does this mean he is not supporting or canvassing for the local Fine Gael election candidates, Joe?
It's a good question. I suppose where I sit at the moment is outside the parliamentary party, so I don't attend parliamentary party meetings. I vote with Fine Gael. I'm supportive of the government. But the only place where I have the difficulty is on the Mica front. And no doubt the Mica issue is going to be a massive issue for both the local and the general election. And in terms of my support, look, I'm just thinking on the likes of locally in my Milford area. I went to Aaron Sweeney's convention. It's the only convention I've gone to. He's in my local area. He started canvassing with me when he was 13 years of age. He's a good young man. And at a personal level, you know, I came in and obviously I'll give him whatever help behind the scenes. But
it does make it a little bit difficult for you on the doorstep because you are on a key issue for Donegal, the top issue, sort of very much outside Fine Gael. So you could find yourself in an awkward position, say, for instance, with you and Aaron at a doorstep. Yeah. You know, I don't want to get into it because it. When you are canvassing for a party, you have to back what the party is saying, of course. So we won't get into that because I don't want to put Aaron in an awkward position. But it would make it probably difficult for you to canvass it in that scenario with whomever it might be with.
Yeah, and look, I have to think seriously about it. And obviously, the candidates, I have to be asked first. If there's candidates in the Fine Gael party that, you know, and ask me to do something, I'm going to obviously try to be as helpful as I possibly can. But I don't want to put them in a compromising position as well, because I've taken a very, very black and white stand on the Mica issue. Like Leo knows where I stand on it as well. I've been speaking on it this week at committee, last week in the Dáil. Potentially, you know, like you've covered this ground so much. Potentially, we have a good scheme, but at the moment, it's not working for a lot of people, and that's where I have a difficulty.
Yeah, we might come back to that actually a little later in the show. Gaza Health Authority said Israeli forces on Thursday shot dead more than 100 Palestinians as they waited for an aid delivery. But Israel blamed the deaths on crowds that surrounded aid trucks, saying victims had been stampled or trampled or run over. And I heard an IDF spokesperson platformed on the BBC framing these victims as robbers and looters, which I just thought was remarkable. At least 112 people were killed, more than 280 wounded in the incident near Gaza City, Palestinian health officials said. Now, every day, 100 Palestinians at least are killed, mostly women and children, 2.3 million in that country, or that enclave, or however one wants to describe it, have had their lives turned upside down through displacement and what have you. Professor O'Connor, like, how is the world standing by and watching this happen? And I don't mean us as individuals. I think we're horrified every single night for what we see. But we see sort of rhetoric and particular use of words and, you know, Joe Biden there speaking, announcing a ceasefire somewhat prematurely because it was advantageous perhaps for him to do so. You know what I mean? These humans, these people, these women and children primarily, it seem to be just pawns. Like, how can it continue as is? It's just impossible for me to get my head around it.
Well, I think it's the most dreadful, depressing episode in many, many years. I suppose I think the problem really is Zionism. And by that, I mean the idea of a Jewish state for a Jewish people. I went to on a holiday, inverted commas, to Israel and Jordan there about 5 years ago, pre-COVID. And at that time, it was very clear, like it was in conjunction with G-Adventures and National Geographic. So we had lectures by various people, and we went to Palestinian camps, and we had lectures by Jewish academics, and we did kosher cooking. So it was very, you were exposed to both cultures. And it was very clear to me at that time that the, as the academic, the Jewish academic said, like there were two views in Israel. On the one hand, there were people who wanted a Jewish state for a Jewish people. And there were people who wanted a democratic state where basically everyone was represented regardless of their background. And in his view, the majority were of the opinion, which is Zionism, this tradition which has basically started, reached an apogee in about 1948 in the Nabka. But in his view, the majority of the Israelis at that time wanted a Jewish state for a Jewish people. And what we have seen is the working through of that. Netanyahu's father was actually one of the lead exponents of this and went to America. I think Joe Biden has actually, I've seen him on record describing himself as a Zionist. I think the whole, I suppose I have found it profoundly depressing, the attitudes of Ursula von der Leyen. I've always been a supporter of the EU. And really, I'm beginning to wonder. Germany's attitude, Rishi Sunak's attitude, even at times Macron's. Like this to me, I'm very clear, this is genocide. The desire is to annihilate the Palestinian people. Yes, what Hamas did on the 7th of October was dreadful, but the whole strategy, Netanyahu's political career is resting on this, and he is making the people of Palestine, ordinary people. The deaths of over 15,000 children, like, to me, it just is.
But there doesn't seem to be any opposition. I think there was a vote recently on going into Rafah, and there was cross-party support for it. So it's not like exact. It's not as if he is, on the brink of being overthrown, because you've got, as I say, cross-party support for such a what seemingly is a horrific action.
Well, there is the, no, I spent an entire day at the Jewish Museum in Jerusalem, and you can see that the what is happening to the Palestinians is a direct mirror image of what happened to the Jews. The media is completely skewed. The whole, what the lines, that the lies that are being fed to the Jewish population is the Israeli population is one part of it. But there is also, I suppose, there is a lack, I mean, the dehumanization, even by the ministers, referring to the ministers and the government, not simply Netanyahu, the Minister of Defense, Minister for Culture, referring to Palestinians as animals. Like, it is unbelievable. So in a way, but the whole how the international structures have operated and how ineffective
they are.
Well,
there seems a great fear to call Israel out for fear of being accused of anti-Semitic. And we're seeing what's happening in England at the moment. It's really actually quite bizarre. Sometimes I can't believe what I'm saying. So if anyone's even slightly critical, they're called anti-Semitic and they have the whip taken off them, or they're roundly condemned or what have you. There's no open conversation, seemingly.
Well, in a way, like, and this is also a huge problem in America, the number of those in Biden's cabinet, I don't know if they're Zionist, but certainly they're Jewish, and the pressure, the political pressure against criticising the government. It is like if we were to, anybody who criticised the Irish government were to be described as anti-Irish. It's preposterous. And yet, such has been the collective Western guilt, I guess, because the West, we have, through the concentration camps, through Germany, through all of that, there is, I mean, a collective guilt about the way the Jews were treated and about the Holocaust. And that seems to be exploited deliberately. But this fusion, but even RTE, I've been, like, they don't make a distinction between Zionism and Jewishness, do you know? And yet there are Torah Jews protesting in Israel and outside it who are saying, you know, we are Jewish, but we do not support the state. We do not support genocide in Palestine. But it is, I mean, I cannot, it's horrific. It's dreadful. You feel so powerless. And I cannot cannot really, it shows how international, the difference in the way the international bodies have responded to Russia's invasion and to Israel's invasion of Gaza. Like, the contrast is so clear. And really, it means that international law is only for some people. And I'm just horrified.
Right, I mean, that is so obvious in that you can see the attitude towards Russia and Ukraine versus Israel and Palestine. There are literally two things going on on the moment that make pretty much every point that you made in terms of international law and what have you. Nicholas Cross, and I mean, I suppose we would hope, wouldn't you, that a country's government reflects the views of the people and the sense and the feeling of the people. Do you believe that's happening currently, Nicholas? I mean, because people are, I think people are either, there's two groups of people. They're so upset that they're actually having to ignore it to some extent, or they are actively calling out what the professor labelled genocide. You're muted, Nicholas. Sorry, just to unmute there so we can hear you, if you don't mind.
Sorry, Greg. I would agree with what Pat was saying. This is genocide. There's no other word for it. And it's the warmongers that keep going on and keep this going on. And for the media to come out last night and saying that people, you know, the tanks were in danger of people running with them looking for food. Any man, woman or child to feed their family would have done the same thing. When food trucks come in, let's try to get your share for your family. And for the media to turn around, but this is all propaganda that's coming out, and there are people who believe it. But what we have in Israel and Gaza, Strip, the West Bank at this present moment in time, is nothing short of genocide. It should be condemned throughout the world. But is there a fear of, because if somebody might, if the Americans come in and directly behind Israel, do the Russians come in behind, or does Iran or Iraq come in behind the Palestinian people? Could it escalate? These are all the questions we have to watch. But what has happened in the moment in Gaza and Israel is an absolute disaster. And we're watching it unfold in front of our eyes. It's just horrendous, to say the least.
I can't imagine either that there weren't drones up, or even, you know, satellite images, but particularly drones up that could very clearly clear up what happened here. But would you have the faith that if America could prove that Israel opened up and just attack these people, would they even release that footage? I don't think they would, Nicholas.
No, I don't think they would either. There were drones up to show people running, but I didn't see anybody. I mean, like, if you're running against a tank, they said there were warning shots fired and people kept running towards the tank, what are they going to do when they get to the tank?
Well, they claimed that they were attaching explosives to the tanks, but I mean, there's absolutely no evidence that actually happened.
The people haven't got food for their children, not alone arms to fight with. I mean, like, this is horrendous stuff coming out from worldwide media coming out on this here. I had to condemn every word that they're saying on it. It's genocide, and it's nothing short of genocide.
Joe, I mean, Ireland has arguably taken a tougher stance on this than others have, but have we gone far enough, given our status, given our history?
I think, look, you're right to identify, like, the Spanish government and Ireland have taken a stand, but it's important to keep that momentum going. It's hard to understand why it's only just Spain and Ireland that's taken this stand, because at the end of the day, and I think it was quite well articulated there by Pat and Nicholas, like, we're talking about innocence here. We're talking about two wrongs to make a right, and all those arguments, false arguments. But my real concern, obviously, the current concern and people dying, people being maimed and people being killed and murdered, we only have to look at the future, and I think there will be consequences for this international indecision, because with all that anger, all that pain, all that hurt, there's going to be consequences, and where does this end? And whatever ever effort needs to be done now is to try to bring a ceasefire as quickly as possible, but there's no confidence, or, you know, there's no light at the end of the tunnel even today that this will happen.
I mean, there is no doubt that the attacks in Israel early October were absolutely disgusting. You couldn't condemn them enough. Horrendous. But so much has happened since that it's almost difficult to frame what's happening now in that context, if that makes sense. And I don't want to be insensitive, but I'm hoping I'm getting my point across. Like, for in the interim, even Joe Biden saying, right, well, hopefully by the end of next weekend, that's 7 days away, that's a minimum of 1,000 women and children killed. That's the problem with people not being able to feed themselves, being displaced, 2.3 million people. Like, the journalists should call out, say, 7 days away, 8 days away. What about the horrendous activity that's going to happen between now and then? It doesn't even take into consideration the devastation that's being delivered on these people, that kind of language.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's a lot of irrational commentary in a vacuum at the moment of fear. And I think Pat was, you know, pointing to the point there that there seems like nobody can argue against what happened, 6 million Jews being exterminated in gas chambers. Nobody can argue against that. But after the attacks, after the Hamas attacks on Israel, and as you pointed out, Greg, like, totally wrong, totally callous, absolutely nobody can condone that. But it seems to have hit some sort of nerve in the psyche of the Jewish people internationally. But anybody looking at this objectively, there's no justification for what's happening today, irrespective of what happened in the past.
Pat, collective punishment in and of itself is contravening God knows what, but there's absolutely no doubt that that's what's happening at the moment.
Yes, like within the, I completely agree with you. That is, it is collective punishment. Its purpose is genocide. But then I suppose, like, Biden articulated the view, which is held by apparently a lot of European leaders, which I struggle to understand, that without a Jewish state for a Jewish people, all Jews are unsafe. Now, that, I mean, in a way, we know that attempts to create like a Protestant state for a Protestant people, and back in medieval times, Catholic states, this kind of thinking does not work, right? And yet nobody is somehow willing to, the best they're coming to is a two-state solution. And to be honest, a two-state solution is totally dead in the water. Because if Israel even had an inch, the Israeli people, not mind the government, had an inch of common sense, if you murder 15,000 of your neighbor's children, you are not contributing to your future security.
And also, too, I mean, the Jewish population, obviously, they feel that that there's a lot of anti-Jewish sentiment and what have you. But this is probably going to be, talking about collective judgment, this is going to do irreparable damage, surely, to the standing of Jewish people across the globe.
Yes, completely. And a small, tiny proportion of Jews, Torah Jews, the people with the ringlets and the skull caps, have realised that. But I suppose to come back to what is so clear is how much lies have been told. For example, the hostages, the three hostages that were shot, basically, their own people shot them, and they initially tried to argue that they were carrying arms, that they were, and it was very clear they came out with their hands up. So that, to me, clearly illustrated that really so much of what has been said.
I mean, even in relation to the attack yesterday, the excuses and explaining away is what you'd expect 3 or 4 8-year-olds to come up with if they were trying to cover up messing up a room in the house or something. That's what beggars believe to me. Okay. Some people are texting and suggesting that things are changing in Ireland. Some are using the word genocide. But let me try and frame what they're getting at is that, you know, they believe Irish culture or Irishness or the Irish are presumably through immigration being forced out of this country. And why is no one talking about that? I mean, these are two very different situations where you have women and children being slaughtered and just left to... I don't know, does any of you want to take that on even? Suggest that something similar is happening here in a different way? Pat, I don't think you do, Joe.
This is again capitalising on a dreadful situation.
Yeah, Is enough being done to fully inform the public on choices and the consequences of the referenda in March? Yesterday we heard Senator Michael McDougall say, if in doubt, vote no. I think that's a very powerful message that those campaigning for a yes may struggle to counter, because it's so complex, and a lot of the concerns that are being put out there are not necessarily the what we're actually voting on, but the consequences of that vote down the line. Nicholas, what do you think?
I agree 100%. It is so, so confusing. And I have read the pros and cons of it, but I have got probably a few issues that I'm not very clear on. Is durable relationship is one. Anything that we leave an open door that's been contested in the courts, I don't think that we're going to finalise it properly. And the other one is to strive to provide provision for the likes of carers. And probably Joe would know, that, but this was rushed through Dáil and Shannon, and very, very little discussion done on it, on the wording of the referendum. Because I did speak to a couple of senators regarding how to come down on this when I read that we're going to talk about it today. The word that the carers, I don't think it's going to provide for carers very, very much within if we change it. There is just a few words on it, right, that I'm going to have to read and read and read over and over again to say which way that I'm going to come down on. But it's looking, what Deputy McDougall, he's come out very, very strong on that if we pass the legislation or the amendment in its current form, that it's open to legislation.
Joe, why was it apparently rushed through or guillotined or not allowed to be amended or language tweaked? Do you have any insight into that?
Not really. Well, I suppose it was supposed to be on the ballot paper a long time ago, and there was a lot of coming and going and to and froing between the legal team, even within the Oireachtas as well, and within the department. So it took a long time to get the wording right, and I think even Nicholas pointed out some of the independent senators, and the one independent senator, Tom Clonan, feels it doesn't go far enough. So I think there was disappointment around that. But in relation to both our amendments 39 to the 40, I think one of the I'd be voting yes for both of them, and that's having informed myself. And even, you know, it is available online, and you just have to go onto the referendum commission. It's still quite technical, and there's a lot of, you know, to digest. But one of the issues I've had for a long number of years was the whole issue of the addition of durable family, like what is a family? And just to give, I've had loads of examples over the years, but I'll give you an example of one, Greg, where a widower at the moment, his wife died a couple of years ago. They got married in the eyes of the church in 1995, following an annulment through the church. But because the divorce referendum didn't happen to 1996, they were never recognised in the eyes of the state. So at this moment in time, this particular widower does not get a widower's pension, even though he was married to a woman who got an annulment.
But we've seen it proven in the court that he's entitled to a widow's pension. The O'Mara case uses current legislation to prove that he is entitled to a pension.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you raise that, because I have a parliamentary question down. The answer I'm getting back is not as clear cut as I would like it to be. But it is, for the O'Mara case, it was the children were involved. So there's no children involved in this relationship. And I ran it by a few barristers. Look, there seems to be people willing to take it on, but it's a very, look, that's one example. There's loads of other examples where dealings, you know, with single
And what's daughters. Interesting about that too is FLAC. FLAC actually funded and backed that case, yet in this area it's advocating for a no. I know it's a yes no, which makes it even, and that's my point, the complexity of this. And as I say, Senator McDougall very clearly says, if in doubt, vote no. And I just wonder how that's going to be counteracted, because I have a number of questions that I'd like to put to you about that scenario. We can't do it now. That eventually, probably, we both have to concede that the courts will have to decide. And I think that's what's concerning and confusing people.
Yeah, and look, there's, it's funny, I had a chat with Tom Cronin yesterday about it, and with a good chat, and obviously he's got a very personal situation with his own son, and I was given examples of the opposite happening with different people with disabilities that have their own independence now, but it boiled, the end of our conversation, it was that the piece that's missing is a piece of legislation, so there's a lot, yes, is resting on a constitutional amendment, but a lot will rest on what laws will follow.
And that's what people are concerned about, because you have the likes of Michael McDougall suggesting that it could get very complicated in terms of family law when a relationship starts and ends, if two can run alongside each other. Pat O'Connor, your view, please.
I think partly... It is, people have become confused. I think a lot of people haven't even registered or are only beginning to register this week that there are two, they'd be asked to vote on two things, because calling it the family one and the care one, because those are so interwoven in people's minds that it's the question for me is, does Michael McDougall, who's had three long opinion pieces in the Times in the past 3 weeks, you know, does Michael McDougall, erudite and a great man as he is, you know, does he represent the future face of Ireland? And I'm afraid my very clear answer is no. I am not comfortable with excluding basically 40% of children from being considered a family in our constitution. Single parents have a durable relationship with their children. If people vote no, they effectively exclude all that raft from the constitutional definition of a family. And I see the constitution as about values. It is about what we, you know, what we value, what we see as the face for the future. And so I am voting on the first one, which is a white, will be a white ticket, as I understand it. I am voting yes. I think what people are also not really recognising is that many things in the Constitution have had to be tested in law. So durable relationships will have to. Way back, right, contraception, there was a famous case way back, the McGee case, which was taken to test, you know, what was the right to privacy. So, durable relationship, okay. Yeah. Have to be tested, but that's the constitution.
Professor Pat O'Connor, thank you so much for your time today. It is always a pleasure, and I mean that most sincerely. Have a lovely weekend.
Thank you, and I'll be voting yes for the second one too.
That's okay. Joe McHugh, thanks very much indeed. Have a great weekend. Take care of yourself.
You too, Greg, and your team, and Nicholas.
All right, bye-bye. And Nicholas, have a wonderful one. Take care. Bye-bye. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much, Greg.
All right,
all the best.
See you soon. All right, bye-bye. Take care. Okay.